The founder of Panasonic once said,
"We can lead more meaningful and constructive lives
through the pursuit of activities that will ensure
a better today than yesterday,
a better tomorrow than today."
Panasonic is committed to creating a greener,
more equitable future for everyone.
Explore Panasonic Green Impact
at na.panasonic.com/green impact.
The most exciting part of a vacation stay at a home rental? Easy. It's being greeted upon arrival with a rusted lockbox affixed to the underside of a stranger's condo. Yeah, you simply twist knobs, click gears, jiggle it, and then rip it off its moorings, and voila! Your prize is a key to a questionable home rental and maybe tetanus. When you just want to get your vacation started by actually getting into your room, it matters where you stay. At Hilton, we deliver your key right to your phone on the Hilton Honors app. Hilton, for the stay.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. West Nile virus is back in the headlines. Just 3 years after it was first discovered in New York, the virus has spread across more than half the United States. West Nile is here to stay, and its explosive spread has exposed dangerous weaknesses in America's public health system. This hour, emerging infectious diseases, maddening mosquitoes, and America's poorest public health defenses. We begin tonight in Louisiana. 7 people have died of West Nile encephalitis there this year, putting public health officials on a war footing in Bayou country. Senator Mary Landrieu plans to ask the Air Force's 910th Flight Wing to spray insecticide in Louisiana's most hard-hit regions. On the ground, health officials are struggling to keep up as the virus spreads. Earlier, I spoke with Dr. Erin Brewer, Regional Medical Director for the Louisiana Office of Public Health. I asked her to describe the region she serves.
My region is the five parish region north of Lake Pontchartrain, which is the big lake north of New Orleans. So I'm east of Baton Rouge and north of New Orleans.
And what's the situation there now? You've had a couple of people just in the last, just in this month who have died. Is that right?
Right. Actually, 4 of the 7 deaths that have been reported have occurred in this region.
In your region of Louisiana and in this parish that you're in as we speak to you today?
Oh, in this parish? Yeah, 2 of them are here.
What's the mood in the parish? Are people upset, or is it seen as something that's just of concern to the elderly?
No, I think people are paying pretty close attention for the most part. We recognize that it's not something that's just occurring in the elderly. It really can happen to anybody in any of the decades. It does happen that what we've seen in the past is that people over the age of 50 develop more severe illness, but any of us could contract the disease.
Do you have any idea how many people in Louisiana have been infected with West Nile virus this summer?
It would be an estimate, and the estimates that we've used in the past have been based on what happened in New York in 1999 in Queens, New York, where they found that something, and this is, again, an estimate, 1 in 200 people who are infected develop encephalitis. And let's just say that about 60 of the people out of 85 have encephalitis. So times 200, that's about 12,000 people infected.
Now, as you say, this was first seen in the States very recently, just in 1999 in New York City.
Right.
How long did it take to travel to Louisiana? When did it first show up there?
The first case in a human was seen last fall in October in a man who died of West Nile encephalitis.
Were any precautions taken in Louisiana before West Nile was found there?
We have St. Louis encephalitis here. It's endemic. Well, it's really endemic in this hemisphere, but we had an outbreak of St. Louis encephalitis in Monroe in the northeast part of the state last summer. So, yeah, we were providing education for the public and providing laboratory diagnosis if a confirmation was needed, doing surveillance for St. Louis encephalitis and West Nile encephalitis.
But that didn't stop West Nile from showing up. Could it have been stopped from making its way to Louisiana somehow?
No, I don't think so. I don't see how it could have been stopped. And, you know, the natural process is for birds to be amplifier hosts. So when the virus gets into the birds, they make numerous copies of it, large numbers of copies. And then when they're bitten, when the virus is still in their blood, then they infect the biting mosquitoes, and then the mosquitoes, after that, infect more birds. And the birds, some of the birds are migratory. Some of the birds fly south for the winter and Louisiana is a big flyover. The Mississippi River is a big flyover from north to south and then from east to west. So I don't think it's possible to stop something like this.
Governor Mike Foster declared a state of emergency in Louisiana last week. I think there's been a lot of spraying going on. Do you feel that everything is being done that could and should be done to address West Nile virus?
I do. You know, the state and many other agencies are all working together to do several things. The state does surveillance, like I mentioned before, laboratory diagnosis, case investigation so that we can understand the patterns of disease. We collaborate with all those other agencies, mosquito control boards and mosquito control districts, parish government, hospitals, healthcare practitioners. We have a multimedia campaign for public education along with a website that has a lot of really valuable information as well as links to other websites. We're doing community forums to answer people's questions and to help people understand what they should be doing. And we're educating providers alongside the physicians who are taking care of the people with the infection. So I think we're looking at it from as many directions as we can.
Are you in a swampy part of Louisiana there near Pontchartrain or not?
Yeah, there's plenty of swamp. There's plenty of water here, around here, yeah.
Does that make people feel more vulnerable or more accustomed to mosquito-borne disease?
You know, that's a really good question, and I think the answer is that both things happen. People are fairly accustomed to living with mosquitoes. A lot of us down here tend to see mosquitoes as pests, but not as dangerous pests. But now, I think this is reminding us that mosquitoes in the past have been dangerous, you know, with malaria and yellow fever, and they're dangerous once again with these different viruses that we haven't seen here before.
Your meeting tonight about the West Nile virus, what kind of concerns do you expect to be shared with you there?
Well, I'll actually meet with the Washington Parish Council that's just north of here, mm-hmm. about 40 minutes. I think people at the local level want to know what is the state doing about this and what can be done about it. They want to have recommendations about whether or not they should have established mosquito control programs with dedicated funds. And they want to hear it from me that we need to take personal preventive measures, protecting ourselves when we go outdoors, eliminating mosquito breeding grounds. Those are the kind of things they want to know about.
Aaron Brewer, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Dr. Aaron Brewer is Regional Medical Director for the Louisiana Office of Public Health. She spoke with us earlier from St. Tammany Parish near Lake Pontchartrain. We're talking tonight about West Nile virus and weaknesses in America's public health infrastructure. Does the rapid spread of this virus signal serious problems in America's public health defenses? If we can't contain West Nile, how will we deal with more deadly threats? In a future of warmer, wetter weather, will the U.S. see more of these exotic epidemics? How can America protect itself, and how are you protecting yourself? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined tonight from Washington, D.C. by T. Gadotti. He's chair of the Department of Environmental and Occupational Health in the School of Public Health and Health Services at George Washington University. Good evening and welcome, T. Gadotti.
Thank you.
Thanks for being with us.
From one swamp to another, I guess.
You're right. Also with us from the studios of Vermont Public Radio is On Point's news analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Hello, Jack.
Hi, Tom. We're high and dry here in Vermont.
long may it stay that way. T. Gadotti, you've been following, along with many others, the spread of the West Nile virus. It's moved into, we read as of tonight, something like 36 states in just 3 years. Is this fast for a virus? And if it is, why has it exploded so quickly?
It's certainly fast for a pathogen. It's not unprecedented, but it certainly demonstrates the potential of a widespread movement of a virus like this when it reaches basically unpopulated territory. The virus has a certain niche. There's nothing quite like it here. Well, actually, St. Louis encephalitis is similar, but there's nothing to retard its progress. So it comes into a population for which there is no immunity. The birds have not seen the virus before. The mosquitoes are already present and just waiting to serve as vectors carrying it from one organism to another. Exploded like wildfire.
Over the weekend, the director of the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control, Dr. Julie Gerberding,
said that she says it's a fine line between outbreak and epidemic, but when you're seeing something that's involving so many people in so many states, it's probably helpful to think of it as an epidemic, emerging infectious disease expanding with West Nile virus. You have made the case that a better public health infrastructure might have slowed or even stopped the spread of West Nile virus? Could it have? Should it have?
I'm not sure I've made that case. The case that I've made is that this is, in effect, a dry run for the introduction of other pathogens of its type into North America. I think that the context that you're referring to is the use of this outbreak by people who are concerned, particularly with bioterrorism, with intentional biological threats, as a kind of case study. There's no evidence that West Nile virus had any intentional component whatsoever. However, it burst upon the scene. Its pattern of propagation and the way in which it was introduced is a test of the public health system, and the test shows that the public health system works in certain areas, but it is generally weak and has great difficulty facing a new challenge of this magnitude.
So you're describing this as a de facto test. No one really designed it as far as we know. No one deliberately introduced West Nile virus, but it has spread now to 36 states in 3 years. And if this had been, are you suggesting some kind of bioterror threat that was introduced not in a bomb or in a letter sent to Capitol Hill, but through some kind of natural means? This is not encouraging about our capacity to stop it?
That's correct. We call things like this, if you will, accidents of nature. Mm-hmm. We call them, quote, natural experiments, close quote. That's the term in science. Mm-hmm. When a circumstance like this happens and we get an opportunity to glimpse the play out of events that we wouldn't normally see because you couldn't construct an experiment to test it. And what we've seen here is a classic case of the propagation of a disease that's dependent on an arthropod vector and
arthropod vector
reservoirs, meaning mosquitoes, mm-hmm. and a reservoir, in this case birds, that attacks a vulnerable population. There's no obvious intervention that we could have done at this point to have stopped it. So all we can do is sit back and watch the natural history and say to ourselves, what can we learn from this?
So I want to be sure I understand. You're suggesting then that if somehow a terrorist had been able to introduce a more lethal pathogen through what looked like natural means, we might or might have found ourselves ill-prepared to confront that threat. Is that right?
I don't think that's controversial. I think that individuals who are currently working in the public health system and who are concerned with preparedness would consider that a given.
But is that even possible? Are there diseases that we would be susceptible to that you could bring in, five sick birds and let them go, I don't know, in Washington, D.C., and then 3 years later you've got a national crisis?
No, none of the suspected or the potential biological agents that are under discussion as most likely pathogens are quite would be spread in quite that way. This is an example of what can happen when the vector is present and when the circumstances are right to disseminate a pathogen, particularly a lethal pathogen. Would require a great deal more sophistication in a delivery system, but the point is that the system is not able to respond to everything. It is limited in how it can respond because of the way that we've structured our society and our medical care delivery system. It's limited in part because of disinvestment over the past 30 years, and we're basically behind the curve. We're trying to catch up. And West Nile virus is probably best perceived as a monumental wake-up call.
Jack Beatty, it sounded like a relatively mild virus, though getting a lot of media coverage. But Tigadati is saying if this had been more serious, what we're seeing here is a lack of capacity to confront something like this.
Well, I don't think there's any question about that. There was a study, I think an experiment, an unnatural experiment, if you will, conducted, I think, in Colorado a few years ago. They called it Dark Winter. We've talked about it before on this program, but it involved a simulated smallpox, I think, or germ warfare attack on a city, and they had all the players in the room, and they responded as they would respond. And in fact, it was a disaster, and it showed that many more people would die than need be. And one of the crucial reasons was there was no public health structure adequate to deal with this kind of threat.
We're talking tonight about the West Nile virus and America's public health defenses. If we can't stop crows with West Nile virus, can we stop a bioterrorist attack? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the West Nile virus and America's public health defenses. Do you want city trucks spraying pesticide in your neighborhood? Are we overreacting to West Nile? Is this just an August media monster? And does a warmer, more interconnected world mean we need more aggressive public health defenses? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined tonight by Tigadati. He's chair of the Department of Environmental and Occupational Health in the School of Public Health and Health Services at George Washington University. Tigadati, I want to understand also the context here of global warming and environmental change, and I guess a more tightly interconnected globe, are whether or not it would be deliberate as through a bioterror attack, as you've suggested, obviously is a possibility. Are we already seeing more exposure to more introduction of diseases that hadn't previously been in the United States?
Yes. I think that previously been, of course, has to be qualified because some of these disorders, like hantavirus, were there before but weren't recognized as such. And then during a period of climate change in the Four Corners area of the Southwest, there was a population explosion of deer mice, and suddenly we had people becoming seriously ill, and in some cases dying, from a disease that nobody had ever described before. And it came as a real shock.
So between a terror threat and a changing climate, you're describing a situation in which we need to be prepared for more various and maybe surprising threats than we have in the past.
Exactly. We need a vigilant and also very flexible public health system. But we've been taking investment out of, we've been disinvesting in public health for the last 30 years.
I don't think most people really know how that process has proceeded. What's gone on? What's been the meat of the disinvestment you're describing?
Well, basically, public health is a victim of its own relative success in the 1940s and 50s. Our ability to cure sexually transmitted diseases, which of course is now failing because of antibiotic resistance, our success in controlling tuberculosis, which is now failing again because of antibiotic resistance, and the degree to which major infectious problems and waterborne outbreaks especially were brought under control in this country basically lulled many decision makers and politicians into a false sense that everything was under control and that they could balance their municipal budgets and their state budgets by keeping the growth of public health static while other things were, or actually take money out of it, while other areas were growing. And the net result is that we've lost ground in real terms, and we now put something like a penny on the dollar in prevention and public health compared to the amount of money that we invest in medical care.
And that may leave us more vulnerable. But what's the scenario here? If everything in public health had been in tip-top shape, the machine was in perfect running order, how would the country have responded differently to West Nile virus? And might it somehow have been nipped in the bud? Might it not be a disease that we now have to look at as a permanent part of the American landscape?
I'll give you, there are two answers to that question, because we can't really go back and re-examine the past. It's always tempting to spin alternate futures, but any science fiction buff will tell you that they're so sensitive to the normal initial assumptions. For example, I could say that we would have a vaccine for West Nile virus now, because we do have a vaccine for horses. We have vaccines for very similar conditions, like Japanese encephalitis. And if we were really vigorous in vaccine development, and our biomedical research and animal testing structure was up to snuff, we would have that particular capability by now. That's
but one in 1999, scenario. No one even anticipated West Nile virus would make the leap from Egypt, I guess, to the United States. So we wouldn't have had the vaccine then, would we?
We might have the capability to produce it quickly. We might have produced it because it is endemic in the Middle East, and our global health infrastructure might have been strong enough to have taken on that, even though it would be a relatively low priority for vaccine research right now. But there's also another scenario, and that is that we would be here today talking about how unusual West Nile virus is and how unique the situation is, instead of comparing it to hantavirus, the hemorrhagic fevers, HIV, dengue, antibiotic-resistant tuberculosis, vancomycin-resistant enterococcus, methicillin-resistant staph.
In other words, discussing it as one of many new threats.
Exactly.
Growing threats.
Exactly.
Once West Nile virus came into the continental U.S., might a better public health system have had the means to contain it or to even rub it out?
That's very, very difficult to say. The only direct intervention I'm aware of is, again, the horse vaccine. The way that we normally control these arthropod or mosquito-borne infections is to control the vector. In other words, mosquito control. Appetite for that has been reduced considerably because of concern about ecosystem damage and reluctance to spray pesticides and so forth. Where that balance is, it's very difficult to say. But there is a trade-off, and vector control is one of the very few tools available to us. On the other hand, I think we have to sound a note of reality, and that's that vector control is not going to be as easy for these mosquitoes as they are for many others, because this is a particularly hardy bug. The bug that carries West Nile, the Culex mosquito, thrives in drought conditions, likes muddy water, and doesn't need much of it. And yet, this is not going to be an easy mosquito to control either.
Jack Beatty, on the smallpox front that we talked about earlier, though, we've been told that if it were to somehow come into the U.S., be introduced perhaps by a terrorist act, that the strategy would be to surround it in a kind of donut formation and vaccinate people around and isolate it, and that would control its spread. We're not hearing a great vote of confidence from Tika Dadi on that kind of approach from our current system tonight.
No, I can't speak to the particulars of this, but, you know, the big, it's almost as if there are two medical models, and we've gotten away from one of them. One of them is the model, I think Dr. Semmelweis was his name. I can be corrected on that. But in the 19th century, a village was in Austria was full of cholera. And he, you know, some people were treating it by dealing with each case. And he noticed that everybody was going to one well. So he tested the water, and sure enough, it was poisoned. It was bad. It was the source of the disease. They dealt with that problem, and they dealt with it as a public health problem, and the disease transmission and cholera stopped in that village. Well, that collective or public way of dealing with medical threat has really declined in this country with our rising individualism over the last 30 years. Now every emphasis is on, you know, the patient, the individual. And so we give people more and more antibiotics, and with the result to the public, what Mr. Gadotti just said. And I think this is a real problem here, because now, suddenly, we are facing threats that call that public institution and that public consciousness that call upon us to have that, and we've allowed this to deteriorate. We've forgotten that the big, big medical advances have come through things like that well.
Mm-hmm. Listeners, we're talking tonight about the West Nile virus and America's public health defenses. Can America be held exempt from global disease in a warmer, more tightly woven world? And are we ready to step up with the kind of public health infrastructure that will be required to stay on top of potential threats, natural or otherwise? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've been talking with T. Gadotti. We're joined now by John Barry. He's a distinguished visiting scholar at the Center for Bioenvironmental Research at Tulane and Xavier Universities. He's currently working on a book about the 1918 influenza epidemic. Good evening and welcome, John Barry.
Thank you. Good evening.
John Barry, you've written an op-ed piece for the New York Times where you've said that the fear of West Nile virus is overblown. We're not staring exactly at that fear tonight, rather at the public health questions that the existence of West Nile virus raises. But to your point in the op-ed piece, do you think this is all blown out of proportion here? Should we look at this as a worrying natural experiment, to use Tiga Dottie's phrase, that indicates some lack of readiness in our public health infrastructure?
Well, first, regarding, I mean, they're really two separate questions.
They are.
West Nile is the shark attack of 2002.
You mean the media frenzy?
Well, frankly, in this case, while the media is largely to blame, I think some of the public health officials have reacted irrationally as well. And rather than correcting the media and doing the arithmetic of the threat, mm-hmm. They've sort of spurred the media on. The reality is, after West Nile emerged in New York, the CDC ran some tests. They discovered out of 2,500 people tested, five, and this is from an area where the disease erupted, mm-hmm. five were infected. Five out of 2,500. Plus, infection does not mean disease. Out of 140 people who were infected, one person out of 140 developed the disease. And you had to go further down the line until someone actually died. So if you simply do the arithmetic, it's not that far from the shark attacks in terms of the threat of this particular disease. There have been seven deaths so far. There are
seven deaths in Louisiana.
Right. There are likely to be more, but the disease is in 36 states. Are there going to be 1,000 deaths? Absolutely not. Will there be 100 deaths? Highly unlikely. Will there be 20? That's conceivable. Would there be 50? Unlikely, but conceivable.
So in public health terms,
36 states,
mm-hmm.
And yet we're spending tens of millions of dollars, I would say wasting tens of millions of dollars, on dealing with this non-threat. That same money should be going into other public health resources, even to the extent of if enough media attention were focused on not driving and talking on cell phones at the same time, you would probably save more lives.
So we've got your perspective on the seriousness of the West Nile threat. What about this question of public health readiness? Is it illuminating for you, or is this just such a small bump under the rug that you wouldn't have expected a stronger public health response in any case?
Well, in this case, the public health response is far greater than the threat warrants. And the larger question that you're raising is a legitimate one, and I would agree with the points that were being made earlier. You know, the way you save lives in large numbers is through public health measures. That was the case 100 years ago when medicine was first becoming scientific, but before they really had any effective drugs, and it's still the case today. You talk about diseases that were introduced into the United States. Really, the first major one would have been yellow fever, which, of course, was also carried by a mosquito. That was reached as far north as Boston in the 1790s, and there was a devastating epidemic in Philadelphia. But right around 1900, bubonic plague entered the West Coast with Chinese immigrants and has now established itself in rodent populations throughout the Northwest. But nobody thinks of bubonic plague as a serious threat to public health, nor should they. But diseases, you know, the more contact America has with the rest of the world, the more it's going to become vulnerable to infectious disease from elsewhere. I certainly would support the strengthening of the public health infrastructure.
Mm-hmm. Chikidati, there's a vote in support of stronger public health and for the perspective that the view that we're likely to see more threats as the world becomes a smaller place and maybe a warmer place. But do you agree with John Barry's assessment that in its own right, West Nile virus is a greatly exaggerated threat?
Well, I think he's viewing the glasses half full, but I think that the I don't think that it's necessarily an exaggerated threat at this juncture, but I'll get to whether or not I think the response to it is exaggerated in a moment. I think that that whenever you get a pathogen introduced into a population like this, it takes a while to achieve an equilibrium. The first people to succumb, or the first individuals, birds or people, are the ones that are most susceptible. Mm-hmm. And then over a period of time, as the virus becomes permanent in that population, some people who have natural resistance will not show signs of disease when they're infected. An equilibrium will be reached. So that process is going to take place. The point is that barring something unforeseen, the virus has now established itself in North America, and it's a permanent part of our public health landscape. I actually share with Mr. or
Barry, John Barry,
opinion that the disease is going to be difficult or impossible to eradicate. I think that everything we know about this mosquito, everything we know about the behavior of the virus, suggests to me that spraying is not going to be terribly effective. I may be wrong, but I can't see it. I think that to that extent, the fact that we've mobilized against this threat and have actually been relatively slow to mobilize against foodborne outbreaks, for example, which are much more common, which do kill many hundreds of people every year in the United States and make thousands ill of completely preventable causes, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yes, that is absolutely true. That is misplaced priorities. But it also is typical when you have something novel introduced. And again, I get back to the real significance of West Nile, which is as a wake-up call and as a natural experiment, not so much because the virus itself is so lethal.
John Barry, do you see the public health infrastructure in the U.S. slowly getting into better gear as the possibility of new threats becomes more evident, the terrorist and otherwise?
Well, I'm not really an expert on the public health infrastructure. Obviously, there's a far greater awareness now, not just because of West Nile, but because of the whole threat of bioterrorism. And I think dollars are going to end up there because politicians react to what people are thinking about and what the media talks about. But back to this specific disease for a second, there is another disease that is very closely related to West Nile that has been in the United States since 1933. It's called St. Louis encephalitis. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. The antibodies cross-react. It infects the same bird population. It has the same mosquito vectors.
It's out there
every year. It doesn't create havoc. It's just that you've never heard of it because it's not called West Nile. I can only speculate, but I do speculate that the reason West Nile has created this furor is because of its name, because people...
A simple name. John Barry, we've got to take a short break. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the West Nile virus and America's public health defenses. Will we have to get used to America with more disease in a warmer, more tightly woven world? And does a warmer, more interconnected planet mean we need more aggressive public health defenses? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined by John Barry, distinguished visiting scholar at the Center for Bioenvironmental Research at Tulane and Xavier Universities, and by Teague Adadi, chair of the Department of Environmental and Occupational Health in the School of Public Health and Health Services at George Washington University. John Barry, we had to cut you off just before you were talking about St. Louis encephalitis, which has been in the United States for a long time and has not turned into the kind of threat that Teague Adadi was, suggesting that this one might.
I think West Nile is very likely to follow the same pattern as St. Louis encephalitis. As I said, they're almost identical diseases, same vectors, same hosts.
That means not to mount into such a great threat. Teague Adadi, what do you make of that?
Well, I think he's right. I think that the natural history is going to be similar. I object to the statement, though, that we would be surprised if it only killed, say, 100 people, because I think that we're talking about a disease that is now here, that's now endemic. And I think that over a period of time, it will slowly take its own toll year after year, and it'll be a nuisance. And for some people, it'll be a tragedy. Some families, it'll be a tragedy. And I think we also have to be very careful in evaluating the future impact of diseases like this that disproportionately affect people with immune compromise and the elderly. After all, we have an aging population. And because of advances in medical care, many more people are walking around, even compared to 5 and 10 years ago, with blunted immune systems through treatment and survival and chemotherapy.
But still want to be able to go to an evening barbecue without fearing for their life.
You can't live in fear. That's true.
John Barry?
I would agree with what was just said. And when I said it might kill 100. I was talking about this year, not year after year after year. But there are a handful of mosquito-borne viruses that cause encephalitis. They generally cause between 150 and 1,000 cases a year, of which roughly 10% die. This is all the diseases combined. West Nile is simply going to join that and group of viruses and may bump up the total. But in a nation of this size, if you're talking about 100 deaths a year, you know, how many millions of dollars are you going to spend to prevent that? It just doesn't make any sense. In Washington, D.C., for example, where the city government last week started sending government workers door to door to warn people about West Nile, because one person who has leukemia and is undergoing chemotherapy and is very weak had developed the disease. That same week, there was a story in the Washington Post about someone who died of asthma because her husband couldn't get through to 911. The public health dollars would be much better spent and save many more lives if it went to hiring more 911 operators than to sending government workers door to door.
A lot of trade-offs here, and we've got that point. John Barry, thank you very much for joining us tonight.
My pleasure. Thank you.
John Barry is at the Center for Bioenvironmental Research at Tulane and Xavier Universities. He's working on a book about the 1918 influenza epidemic. Frank is on the line. Welcome, Frank. You're on the air.
Thank you. I mean, in fact, the flu is a very good example. Even now, we kill 20,000 people a year with flu. And as a public health official in a city in Massachusetts who deals with public health infrastructure on a day-to-day basis, I find the West Nile virus really puerile in terms of the emphasis put on that, given the other problems I'm dealing with, which is tuberculosis. Immigrants are bringing in all sorts of issues that we have to deal with, the normal diseases that we face. I went through anthrax during the false anthrax episode, and again, the structure almost collapsed under that weight of that particular episode.
But Frank, what about the point Tegedotti has made here that it's a kind of a wake-up call because of all the attention it's got?
Yeah, well,
did you agree that there are problems in the public health infrastructure?
There absolutely are. For example, CDC gave Massachusetts $19 million for this whole issue. Not one red cent of that is going to the local health departments. I actually had a 10% budget cutback. I'm less prepared than I was last year, and I wasn't very well prepared last year. So the issue still is that we were formed originally as governmental public health, using the police powers of the state to protect against communicable disease, going back to the last century, the mm-hmm. century before that.
Mm-hmm.
If we have a major outbreak, a smallpox or whatever, that has mass casualties, or even a 1918 flu, we are not prepared at all. I mean, small numbers, 7 or 8 people, that's not a problem. If you're dealing with 5, 6, 7,000 deaths or injuries or infections, that's something the system can't handle. And nobody's prepared to deal with that yet because they look at it, glance away, and basically don't want to deal with what it's going to cost to bring us back to what it takes to do it.
Frank, thank you for your call. Tegedotti, there's a report from the front line saying he doesn't have – West Nile virus may not be his first concern, but he doesn't feel he has the resources he needs working in public health to address much more serious threats.
Exactly. And I couldn't have asked for a better illustration of the basic point that the importance of West Nile is not necessarily itself as a public health threat, although, as I mentioned, it'll be a tragedy for some families, mm-hmm. but it's not the widespread threat. It's what it represents. And it points up, and frankly, I'm thankful for that whenever a wake-up call is paid attention to, whether it's a big or a little public health threat, if it happens, I hope people appreciate its significance. And the significance of West Nile is that we remain very vulnerable. It's may I address this issue of preparedness against bioterrorism for a moment?
Yes.
We are this is a classic example, as is what Dr. Berry referred to as the overreaction to West Nile, and what I would tend to characterize as the usual response to a novel hazard when mm-hmm. it surprises people. We are capable, it seems, of only responding all full speed ahead or dead in the water. We seem to be incapable of moderating or titrating our response. The issue with bioterrorism is a really good example. Here we are pulling out all the stops. We're creating a new cabinet-level department. We're vesting it with public health functions. We're basically creating a purpose-built system that is entirely focused on something that may, we hope, never happen.
You mean a general terrorist attack or a bioterrorist attack?
Well, let's speak about bioterrorist attack only because, because it's more comparable to the traditional public health mm-hmm. Threats that we face. So we're creating.
Mm-hmm. Excuse me,
But I just want to understand, Tegedotti. You're saying that we're all revved up to address a threat. Is that a bad thing?
No, if we're all revved up to address a single threat, when we have things coming at us all the time from all directions.
Mm-hmm. Jack Beatty, do you see that as a problem in our political system, that it's all or nothing?
Yeah, you know, and it's called the CNN effect. It came in first in foreign policy. I mean, we saw it was the first place it used was in Somalia, where video of people starving helped to provoke the American intervention there, for better, certainly for better, and also for worse. And then something similar happened in the Balkans. Now it's happening at home. I watched some CNN last week, and that news service, and I think the others as well, they have a vested interest in magnifying these dangers, in whipping up disproportionate fears, and in mobilizing, what are people doing? Well, why aren't they doing more? And that creates, I think, what John Barry was talking about, where you get a disproportionate reaction to a threatening but by no means grave presence threat to our health. And that CNN effect is working now with diseases.
And maybe, Jack, to Tegedotti's point, it also takes away from the unsexy threats.
Absolutely.
So they're not dealt with in
immunization.
As they might be.
Pneumonia, diphtheria, tuberculosis, all the rest of that. That doesn't, you know, maybe if they called it, you know, Congo River tuberculosis, it would get attention. I don't know.
Tigadetti, our time is running down here. Do you see in all this some things that have been done right?
Well, I think the basic public health system functions remarkably well, given that it's on such a shaky foundation. I think that that we can learn lessons from its flexibility, the emphasis on surveillance and advanced planning. There are a lot of things in the public health system that work extremely well. We should strengthen it.
Let's hope that we do. Tigadetti, thank you very much for joining us tonight.
My pleasure.
Tigadetti is chair of the Department of Environmental and Occupational Health in the School of Public Health and Health Services at George Washington University. Listeners, you can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click there on forums. Coming up, California braces for the West Nile virus. Jack, thanks for being with us this hour.
Thank you, Tom.
This is On Point. California's battle to keep the West Nile virus out of its backyard is being waged not only by scientists and researchers, but also by chickens. Like canaries in the coal mine, over 200 flocks of closely monitored chickens have been strategically placed around the state to serve as an early warning network of West Nile arrival. In this radio diary, Stan Husted, who coordinates California's encephalitis response team, explains why chickens have been enlisted in the fight against West Nile virus.
We have been able to figure out where the mosquitoes that can transmit encephalitis, not just West Nile, but also St. Louis encephalitis and Western equine encephalomyelitis, and that is where we have put these particular flocks at. So we consider that these are really in prime locations because we know that we're not going to have West Nile unless we have the high mosquito populations, and then they're going to be feeding on these chickens. We go ahead and test chickens, and the reason for that is severalfold. One is the mosquitoes that we know are going to be transmitting West Nile that also transmit the Western equine encephalitis and the St. Louis feed on birds. I mean, if a person is standing there and a bird is there, they're going to go to the bird. And with chickens being birds, that's a good target. But one of the real advantages of these chickens is that they do not get sick. What happens is they just go ahead and develop the antibody to it. So they're an absolutely perfect sentinel animal. They don't have any ill effects from the disease, and yet they tell us when they've been exposed to it. One of the reporters had made a comment that he could just visualize the whole border of California with having these sentinel flocks there. But in reality, what we do have is that we have it in most of the counties here in California, and especially in those counties where we know that we have these mosquitoes breeding. But what we're really expecting is for West Nile to come into those areas which are really nice and warm for the virus, and where we've had the St. Louis or the Western up here before. I think we in California have taken the attitude that West Nile virus is coming. It's not a question of if, it's more of when. But I can assure you that we are not putting out the welcome mat for West Nile virus to come into our state. In fact, what we're hoping is and planning is that with our surveillance system being so widespread and being experienced at this, after utilizing all of the information and expertise that we've gotten from the East Coast, is to detect it as soon as it gets here, so then that local mosquito district and the neighboring ones can control that population. So I think given, you know, our program, giving our what and all that, that it is truly possible for us to really control West Nile once it gets to California.
Stan Houston coordinates California's encephalitis response team. On Point is produced by Micheline Boudreau, Meghna Chakrabarty, Eileen Imada, John Roberts, James Ross, Keith Shields, and Karen Schiffman, with help from Tim Skog, Darren Manoogian, and Samantha Sodikson. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
And this is WBUR. We're funded by you, our listeners.